Thanks, Kendrick. Thanks for the introduction, and thank you all for being here or calling in on Zoom. So I'm excited to be at Perimeter today and to tell you about our effort to map the universe at 21 centimeters. So we're building novel radio telescopes to carry out this measurement. One of those is shown here. This is the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, or CHIME. And CHIME will be the main focus of this talk. Specifically, I'm going to be.
You should need a pointer. You know,
Thanks.
If you're going to my gig, you
Yeah.
know how to use
Yeah, so I'll be describing a first detection of cosmological 21 centimeter emission with CHIME that represents a milestone in our effort to use 21 centimeter intensity mapping to constrain cosmology. Okay, so I'll start by describing 21 centimeter intensity mapping and hopefully convincing you that it is indeed a promising probe of cosmology. I'll provide an overview of the CHIME instrument. I'll describe the cross-correlation analysis that led to our first detection. I'll then describe the approach we've taken to model the cross-correlation signal and constrain the large-scale clustering of neutral hydrogen. And then I'll try to give a realistic outlook on future science results to expect from CHIME and its successor, CHORD. So over the past 30 years, the field of physical cosmology has seen dramatic progress, and this has led to the development of the concordance model, LambdaCDM, which does a spectacular job at predicting most of our existing measurements. But despite this progress, there's still many interesting questions. Is general relativity a complete description of gravity? Is inflation the correct description of the early universe? What is the nature of dark matter? What is causing the accelerated expansion of the universe? So significant progress can be made on all of these questions by mapping out the large-scale structure of the universe to high redshifts. The matter distribution contains observational signatures that allow us to probe each of these questions. We can examine the growth rate of structure. Deviations from our expectation would indicate perhaps a modified theory of gravity. And study the statistics of the matter distribution on the largest scales and look for evidence of non-Gaussianity or departures from scale invariance, both of which would be signatures of inflation. We can study the matter distribution at small scales to rule out different models for dark matter. And then finally, we can use the imprint of baryon acoustic oscillations on the matter distribution as a standard ruler to chart out the expansion history of the universe and constrain models for dark energy. This last observational signature is what we plan to measure with CHIME. So baryon acoustic oscillations, or BAO, refer to sound waves that propagated in the baryon photon fluid of the early universe. And these are frozen in at recombination, leaving an excess of matter at a characteristic scale called the sound horizon that persists to present day. The BAO are imprinted on the temperature fluctuations of the CMB and are responsible for the acoustic peaks in the power spectrum. And our exquisite measurements of the CMB means that we have a very precise constraint on the physical distance of the sound horizon. So if we can then detect the BAO feature in the matter distribution at later times, we can compare the angular size of the BAO to its known physical size and thereby obtain the angular diameter distance to that redshift. Similarly, the size of the BAO in the redshift or line of sight direction tells us the expansion rate. And both of these quantities probe the underlying cosmology. So the most successful method so far for mapping out the matter distribution on large scales has been spectroscopic galaxy surveys at visible wavelengths. An example of this is shown on the right. So this is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Each point in the map is a galaxy with polar coordinate indicating angular position and radial coordinate indicating redshift. And if you count up pairs of objects in the map as a function of their physical separation and compare that to a random distribution, you get this two-point correlation function, which increases as you move towards smaller scales, indicating that galaxies cluster. But you see this bump at very large physical separations, which is the EAO feature that was imprinted on the matter distribution in the very early universe. So this measurement has now been carried out by several surveys using different samples of galaxies at different effective redshifts. This is a more modern measurement from the BOSS collaboration, and it's shown here in both configuration space, correlation function, or in Fourier space. In configuration space, it's a bump. In Fourier space, it transforms into this wiggle. And there are sort of three well-defined peaks, and beyond that, towards higher k, you start to occupy smaller scales where nonlinear effects become significant. So an alternative newer technique is 21 centimeter intensity mapping. This uses the hyperfine transition of neutral hydrogen, where the proton and electrons transition from having their spin aligned to anti-aligned and release a 21 centimeter photon. So this happens very infrequently, but because of the large abundance of neutral hydrogen, there should be a signal that is detectable throughout cosmic time due to 21 centimeter emission. And because there are no comparably strong spectral lines at wavelengths larger than 21 centimeters, you have a relatively clean mapping between observing frequency and redshift. And this is illustrated nicely in this plot from the Parkes telescope, which shows the 21 centimeter emission in the direction of the galaxy NGC 3419. So you see a large peak at 1420 megahertz due to the intervening Milky Way. 1420 corresponds to the frequency of the 21 centimeter wavelength. But then you see a second peak at lower frequencies due to 21 centimeter emission from that galaxy. And you can basically just read off the redshift of the galaxy from this figure. And you have sort of line of sight, redshift or line of sight information for free as part of this measurement. So the idea is to make a low resolution map of the sky at radio frequencies. So here I've taken the SDS map and smoothed it to chimes half a degree resolution. And each pixel of this map will contain the aggregate 21 centimeter emission from many galaxies. The observing frequency mapping to a particular redshift slice now. And we now have a measurement that is tuned to our scale of interest, the BAO scale, and a straightforward way to probe higher redshifts, basically just move to lower radio frequencies. So this diagram represents the entirety of the observable universe, scaled such that area is equal to co-moving volume. And the shapes near the center of the diagram are the small corners of the universe that were mapped out by the first few spectroscopic surveys that measured the BAO. The current state-of-the-art BOSS survey is in dark green and has a footprint that's a factor of several larger. CHIME could potentially map out a large chunk of the universe that nicely fills in the region between the BOSS measurements.
Question, so as you go distance, how can you tell the difference between a radio signal that is coming from way out there versus being more local, so some source of lower frequency?
Yeah, definitely. That's a huge issue. That's probably the biggest issue in 21 centimeter intensity mapping is distinguishing 21 centimeter signal from the foregrounds. And I'll discuss that in detail in a few slides, but basically you're relying on the fact that the foregrounds are spectrally smooth, whereas the 21 centimeter signal varies rapidly with frequency. So you distinguish it on the basis of spectral scale. So the next generation spectroscopic survey, DESI, is shown here and has probes of volume similar to CHIME and is highly complementary to CHIME in both the sky that they're surveying and the redshift overlap. So if we push to lower radio frequencies, there's just a huge volume available to measure. There's a large number of large-scale linear Fourier modes here. And these modes have undergone less processing by sort of nonlinear clustering and astrophysical evolution. So you can more easily relate these large-scale linear modes to physics of the early universe. And then 21 centimeter intensity mapping is one of the one of several promising methods for measuring the epoch of reionization when the first stars neutralize the intergalactic medium, and also one of the only methods for measuring the cosmic dark ages, where the universe was primarily neutral hydrogen and opaque. So there are a number of experiments being developed to go after the lower frequency, higher redshift universe with 21 centimeter intensity mapping. And the instrumentation and algorithms that we're developing for CHIME are highly transferable to those experiments and vice versa. So this plot shows the BAO scale in the angular and line of sight or frequency direction as a function of redshift or equivalently radio frequency. The blue lines correspond to the first, second, and third peaks in the BAO of the BAO in the power spectrum. And then this shaded region here is the scale, are the scales accessible to CHIME. So we first chose our observing frequency to cover the redshift range that hadn't been measured yet by spectroscopic galaxy surveys. We then chose our angular and frequency resolution to resolve the third BAO peak at high redshifts, or at the lower frequency end of our band. And that sets the longest baseline. You need a 100 meter baseline to measure the third peak and the physical size of our instrument. Some other considerations, we're interested in large scales, so we need to map a large volume. And we'd like to maximize sensitivity to these scales, so we're going to build a close-packed interferometer. And this hasn't been done before, so we have to limit the cost. These considerations inform the design of CHIME. So CHIME is a radio interferometer that was specifically designed to measure the BAO, the distribution of neutral hydrogen between redshift 0.8 and 2.5. Construction of CHIME was funded by four Canadian institutions, and we now have partners throughout the U.S. and Canada, including the Perimeter Institute. So this is a video from a drone flight over CHIME. CHIME consists of four large cylindrical dishes that resemble snowboarding half pipes. Each dish is 100 meters wide and 100 meters long, 20 meters wide, for a total collecting area of 8,000 square meters. The focal line of each of these dishes is populated with 256 dual polarization antennas. Each polarization of each antenna is connected to an analog receiver chain that amplifies and feeds the sky signal into a digital correlator. So we have a total of 2,048 analog receiver chains. The correlator is a sophisticated networking and signal processing instrument that performs interferometry on the 2048 element array. And measured in the number of elements squared times the bandwidth, it's the largest radio correlator in the world.
Well, can I just say for scale, those white boxes are, what, 40-foot shipping containers?
Yeah, 40-foot shipping containers.
Big.
So CHIME's located at the DRAO, which is in the Okanagan Valley of British Columbia. This is a picture of the observatory, so you can see CHIME and also a proof of concept for CHIME called the Pathfinder. The primary consideration when picking a site for a radio telescope is the man-made radio frequency interference, or RFI. So these mountains shield the observatory from the RFI generated by nearby cities. And the valley is a legally protected radio quiet zone, but even still, we're masking 40% of our band due to persistent sources of RFI. So this is the power measured by the telescope as a function of radio frequency. You see these dramatic increases in known 6 megahertz wide bands, which correspond to broadcast TV. And then we also suffer from the LTE cell phone bands at higher frequencies. So each of these red shaded regions corresponds to a range of redshift that will not be accessible from the DRAO. In order to access those redshifts, you'd have to build a radio telescope at a more remote location.
The Pathfinder is not used for anything now.
It's no longer used, yeah.
So why is it not in the same
model? I'm sure we will do that eventually, but it was used as a test bed for a while, even after we had built CHIME for new projects, and that may still be the plan.
Wouldn't you just run cables and use it again?
What's that?
Wouldn't you just run cables and use it again? I mean, it extends the baseline. Wouldn't it increase the resolution? Sorry, the angular resolution?
I think there have possibly been baseband dumps and cross-correlation of Pathfinder and Chime data to demonstrate various techniques. I don't know that you would gain much in terms of the resolution with that additional baseline.
We're in the process of building Pathfinder scale instruments in California and in West Virginia. The Pathfinder is sort of
So CORD is fully funded. It's the next generation intensity mapping experiment, and it will live at the DRAO in between CHIME and the observatory buildings. And that's scheduled to be completed in 2025 and should be an order of magnitude more powerful than CHIME. So CHIME is not a traditional radio telescope, so the next few slides will just quickly describe how it works. In a specific characteristic that I can, in mapping speed, which is basically the sensitivity times the number of beams times the redshift range. And I'll go over this in towards the end of the talk. So it's a drift scan telescope. It's always acquiring data, looking at whatever part of the sky is directly overhead and relying on the Earth's rotation to move the field, the sky across its field of view. If you consider a single antenna on one cylinder, in the east-west direction, the cylinder is a 20-meter parabolic dish, which focuses the light and gives you this 1 to 2 degree narrow field of view. In the north-south direction, the cylinder is just a flat reflector, so you get a huge 100-degree field of view in that direction. And I'll refer to this hot dog-shaped response pattern as the primary beam throughout the talk. The focal line of each cylinder has 256 antennas, which feed into the correlator, and the correlator can effectively mimic the parabolic dish and digitally add phase delays to the signal coming from each of the antennas before summing them, such that radiation from a particular location on the sky adds coherently. And with the digital correlator, you can do that for multiple pointings on the sky. We're able to synthesize 256 independent beams along the meridian. And this process or this operation is referred to as beamforming. So we can do the same thing in the east-west direction by combining the signal from antennas on different cylinders. And the end result is this extremely large field of view sampled at less than half a degree resolution with an enormous 8,000 square meter effective collecting area and, as a result, high mapping speed.
Silly question, but so they're all aligned. Would there have been any funny use to stagger them a little bit so that you now have, because they are dark fringes all through as I go in this direction, right? Had I moved slightly each one.
Oh, staggered the antennas in order to get
tubes.
Yeah, that does have some nice properties. Although maybe it makes the beamforming more challenging to do. In particular, we suffer from aliasing. So, and I'll go into this in a little bit, but I think that would solve the aliasing issue. So this shows the radio sky drifting through the field of view of a CHIME antenna. We observe the equator for about 15 minutes each day, and then the north celestial pole continuously. And we map out the entire northern radio sky once per day. So this is an example of the northern sky at 670 megahertz created from a single day of CHIME data. So we take each time sample that's shown on the x-axis and beamform to a grid of declinations spanning the meridian or along the meridian on the y-axis, and that forms this rough map. It's very close to the raw data, so we've made no attempt to correct for the transfer function of the instrument. And you can see several very bright point sources, so Tau A, Virgo A, Sig A, and Cas A, and the sun, the radio emission from the sun. So they all take this sort of U-shaped track through the map. And you're just, what's happening is these sources are so bright, you're seeing them in the very far side lobes. So you can see the sun every time, or whenever it's above the horizon. And then you can also see emission, galactic synchrotron emission here. And there are a number of supernova remnants that are obvious, these sort of extended features. And then just a whole population of extragalactic point sources. So all of this is foreground that the 21 centimeter intensity, or the 21 centimeter signal is a small perturbation on top of this. We need to remove all of what you see here to get at that signal.
What was the difference between the purple in the center and the black edges? Is it day? No, it's not day and night.
Purple in the black edges?
How's it purple in the center?
Yeah, so, yeah.
Why is there more emission in the morning?
Yeah, you'll notice that this is negative. This actually goes negative. Negative. Basically, what's happening is we're discarding the autocorrelation data, the total power measured by each antenna, because it's not very clean. It contains a lot of other stuff. And because of that, you have no measurement of the DC level of each column of this image. So because there are bright features in the DC is basically set to zero. So because there are bright features due to the galaxy, you need a corresponding negative feature here. Does that make sense? Like the mean of each column is set to zero because we're discarding that information. Yeah, so if you wanted to make like a precise measurement of the flux of these sources, you would need to somehow fill that in with another measurement made by a different telescope, or clean up the autocorrelation data such that you could use it. Yeah.
So if I'm to build something on the moon, like all of these things still depends, right?
Sorry.
Like all of these things, like you're going to see the same, like even if you build something on the moon.
Yes. This sort of astrophysical foreground will be there for any experiment. Yeah.
Say what the antipodal, like Hassan, is that when you can see it over the top of the celestial sphere?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So you see the transit on both sides of the pole. Yeah.
You're at +50 north.
Yeah.
Over the pole, like you can see the North Pole all the time, but you can also see past the pole, right? So you can see things that are on the that you will see right side up in another 12 hours.
Yeah, this this map is very close to the raw data, so it has a lot of funny features like that. I think, yeah, if you did a bit more processing, you would try to put all of that flux back into the proper location in the sky.
Power move, having deck go to 120.
So CHIM has three primary science objectives. It was originally conceived as an intensity mapping experiment, but the combination of a wide bandwidth, large field of view, and high sensitivity also makes it an excellent tool for detecting radio transients and monitoring known pulsars. So the fast radio burst backend has been enormously successful. Primer Institute played a lead role in the development of that backend. CHIM has detected more than 1,000 fast radio bursts at this point and will detect several thousand over its lifetime. And this large sample from a single telescope will be crucial in constraining models for the progenitor and emission mechanisms of FRBs. CHIM also monitors all known millisecond pulsars in the northern hemisphere. Among other things, that's used to time the set of nanograv pulsars at a daily cadence to aid in the detection of gravitational waves. So here is the current status of the intensity mapping part of the experiment. So we've been acquiring data now for 4 years and have about 450 days of total integration time after flagging bad data. The results that I'll show in this presentation use only the first 50 days. We've made significant progress on instrument calibration. So we now have a full sky model for the primary beam that we think is accurate at the 5% level, and our complex gain calibration, or the response of each receiving element, we think is good at the 1% level. We're focusing on improvements to primary beam calibration, foreground filtering, cross-correlation with other tracers of large-scale structure, power spectrum estimation, and then we're also doing some galactic science and slow radio transients, so transients on timescales of one day to many days. So,
understand. So you have these like integration time is significantly lower than the
yeah.
time. So the rest is maintenance or what? The rest of the time, what is happening?
Yeah. So the big one is daytime data. The radio emission from the sun corrupts all of the daytime data, so we lose 50% there. The next biggest one is actually rain. So the feeds get wet and
the weather conditions.
Yeah.
What's like snow? Feet get red when it snows, and
you. Well, when the snow melts, if you have a lot of snow on the dish, then that will also cause problems. The chime was specifically designed, or specifically used this mesh to reduce the amount of snow accumulation. It's only really wet snow that causes issues.
You just put it in a box.
Yeah. Well, it has to be transparent to radio waves, but yeah, that's the idea. That's what's being done for both Chord and the chime outriggers, which are give it a long baseline for FRB localization. So each antenna has basically a weatherproof box, yeah, that it lives in. Right. So I'll now describe the analysis that we used to extract the 21 centimeter signal. So as we discussed earlier, the most significant challenge is separating the 21 centimeter signal from foregrounds. On large scales, the radio sky is dominated by synchrotron emission from our galaxy. And then on smaller scales, it's dominated by emission from extragalactic point sources. So that's sort of illustrated here with the Haslam map at 408 megahertz, and then the NVSS survey. Each of these points is a different extragalactic point source measured at 1.4 gigahertz. And if you were to smooth this to chime's half a degree resolution, you would find that, you know, every pixel has a source, a bright extragalactic point source in it. So this shows a simulation of the radio sky. Here we're showing galactic synchrotron and extragalactic point sources, polarized galactic synchrotron and 21 centimeter emission. And if you compare the color scales, you see the problem. So the foregrounds are 10 to the 5 times brighter than the signal of interest. But this bottom row shows the spectral dependence of each of the top rows, each of the top panels in a narrow region indicated by the black line. And you'll notice that the foregrounds are expected to be spectrally smooth, whereas the 21 centimeter signal decorrelates or varies rapidly as a function of frequency because you're seeing emission from physically distinct structures along the line of sight direction. So this is one basis in which you can separate the foregrounds from the signal. A simple way is just to apply a high pass filter along the frequency axis to your map. And that's actually the approach we've taken for this analysis.
Sorry, so if I have a bunch of radio pulsars, where would they be? So where is foreground?
Radio pulsars. Yeah, I guess they probably do have some non-trivial spectral dependence, but the fact that they turn on and off, I guess, would average those down pretty significantly. Okay, so after reionization, most of the neutral hydrogen in the universe is tied up in galaxies, the interior of galaxies. So for this first analysis, we used existing spectroscopic surveys of galaxies to tell us where to look for the neutral hydrogen. We cross-correlated CHIME data with three tracers of large-scale structure from the EBOS clustering catalogs. So emission line galaxies, luminous red galaxies, and quasars. This shows a map of the radio sky, a slightly nicer map constructed from CHIME data, and I've overlaid the footprints of each of these three tracers from EBOS. And then on the right, you can see the redshift distribution, or equivalently frequency distribution of the tracers. So we have, so quasars are in green, they have excellent overlap with our band. The LRGs and ELGs are in orange and blue, and they are distributed at the low redshift end or high frequency end of our band. The regions in gray are inaccessible due to persistent sources of RFI. For this first analysis, we just focused on this region between the black lines because it's clean of RFI.
Spectroscopic.
So the procedure is to make a map of the sky at each radio frequency, apply a high-pass filter along the frequency axis to remove the spectrally smooth foregrounds, mask any residual foregrounds that make it past that high-pass filter, and then for each source in a spectroscopic catalog, extract a spectral cube that's centered on the source's location, centered on its angular position, and also the frequency corresponding to its redshifted 21 centimeter emission. So that procedure is illustrated here along the line of sight direction. So each panel is the spectrum for the map pixel closest to a quasar after applying that high pass filter. The red dashed line indicates the quasar's redshift. The catalogs we're using have tens of thousands of sources. Each of these panels, each of these sources is noise dominated. But if you shift the spectra so that they line up on the quasar's location and then average, do a weighted average over sources, the noise integrates away and you're left with the 21 centimeter emission in the vicinity of the source. So I'll just quickly walk through each stage of the data processing and show the CHIME map for a single frequency channel zoomed in on the relevant EBOS field. So this is the raw map. It's dominated by diffuse galactic emission and bright extragalactic point sources. If instead we construct the map from only baselines consisting of feeds on different cylinders, you get this. So now the long east-west baselines resolve out that diffuse galactic emission, and you're left with primarily the emission from extragalactic point sources. So everything you see here is just point sources. And this baseline selection is roughly equivalent to applying a high-pass spatial filter along the right ascension axis. And we've compressed the color scale here by a factor of 15 relative to what was shown on the previous slide. So this is a foreground filter, a spatial foreground filter, effectively. And then this is the same map after applying the high-pass filter along the frequency axis to remove the spectrally smooth foregrounds. So now the color scale has been compressed by a factor of 300 relative to the previous slide. So this is starting to look noise-like. There are still residual foregrounds, and most notably are these huge tracks, these U-shaped tracks, which are very bright sources in the far side lobes. But you're also seeing emission from slightly lesser bright foregrounds in the main lobe of the primary beam that's getting through the foreground filter. But we can compare to a Gaussian noise realization with variance equal to our expected thermal noise. And you can see that for a large fraction of the field, we're getting down to near the thermal noise limit. And the residual foregrounds are localized, so we can apply a spatial mask to remove them. If you throw away any excursion greater than 3 times the expected noise level, you get something that looks like this, which is now looking very much like thermal noise. And this throws away about 6% of the pixels in the field. And this is the final map that we stack the eBOS catalogs on. So I think it's probably worth stopping here briefly to describe previous analyses that have stacked on spectroscopic galaxy catalogs. In all cases, these have been interferometric measurements that probe small angular scales and are primarily sensitive to the emission from individual galaxies rather than from the surrounding large-scale structure. So the most recent example in this redshift range is from GMRT. They have a 5 sigma detection here, and there are higher signal noise measurements at lower redshift, going up to 13 sigma. And these are usually used to infer the mean H1 mass of the sample of galaxies, and that's useful for studying galaxy formation. There have also been measurements of the cross power spectrum between radio observations, or 21 centimeter, and these catalogs. So this is the state of the art from the Green Bank telescope. And so in contrast to the stacking analysis that was just mentioned, these are primarily measuring clustering, the large-scale structure. And CHIME shares similarities to both of these techniques. So we're doing a stacking analysis, like the one shown on the previous slide, but our synthesized beam has a much poorer resolution than GMRT. So we are picking up the large-scale clustering of neutral hydrogen, as is the case for these single-dish cross-power spectrum measurements. And this is the result from CHIME. So the top row here is the stack signal along the line of sight direction, or frequency direction. And then the bottom row is in the angular direction. So we see a very clear peak at the spectral and angular location of all three tracers. And this represents the first interferometric 21 centimeter intensity mapping measurement. And also the quasars are the highest redshift 21 centimeter intensity mapping measurement.
How sensitive is to your cosmology model? So if you vary the expected frequency redshift, does it get washed out right away? So I'm wondering if you can then use it to test the cosmological model.
I'm not sure that we've looked at that. I'm guessing there would be other effects on small frequency scales that would be dominant, but yeah, I don't know that we've looked at that.
It's very it's kind of very data based, right? It's taking the SDSS measured redshifts, so that's even including, you know, peculiar velocities, shifting the radio data to match to be centered on that redshift. So, you know, it's even measuring it at the same peculiar velocity, for example. So I think it's kind of immune to cosmological interpretation in some ways, because it's very just like where you move, where you probe in the data queue.
Is there any information in the angular
dimension? So at the moment, what we're seeing is consistent with an unresolved point source. Our angular resolution is about 10 megaparsecs at these redshifts, whereas the frequency resolution is 3 megaparsecs. So our synthesized beam is larger effectively in the angular direction. With this analysis, we're not detecting anything outside a single synthesized beam.
So what is the signal to noise for these?
So this is showing. So in order to characterize the noise, we stack on 10,000 random mock catalogs. The range of values we observe are shown by the gray lines. And then we fit a model for the signal, and I'll go into that in a moment, but that's shown by the red line. So we're getting a signal to noise between 6 and 11 for the ELGs to the quasars. And the residuals after subtracting the model are consistent with our noise model, or our noise characterization based on the random Mach catalogs. The signal in red, or our prediction for what the signal should look like, has this funny shape, and that's because of the foreground filter that we're applying. So we're effectively convolving the 21 centimeter signal with the impulse response of the foreground filter, and that introduces these negative shoulders on either side of the peak. So if you apply no filter, you would expect to see just like an exponential fall off, which is the large scale clustering of matter. But then applying the filtering to get rid of the foregrounds introduces these negative shoulders and the ringing. And then the quasar measurement has a pretty high signal to noise, so we can split that up into three different redshift bins. And we have a clear detection in each of these bins, ranging from 6 sigma to 8 sigma. And here you can start to, you know, use measurements from a single telescope to probe the redshift evolution of the 21 centimeter signal. We're going out to 1.4, but that's mainly set by, that's a choice we've made to focus on a clean part of our data. In principle, we can go out to 2.5, and the quasar catalog goes out to 2.2.
Here in the model, so the frequency, you know where the frequency is coming from. The amplitude is what's an estimate of how often this effect is playing out in each galaxy given the mass. I mean,
Oh, well, yeah, I'll actually go into that now. Yeah, so how do we interpret that? And it actually is pretty challenging because we are removing most of the large-scale linear modes with the various foreground filters that we're applying. So the minimum scale probed in either direction is set. So that's what's showing here. It's roughly the scales that we're probing with this measurement for three different frequencies. And the minimum scale is being set by the spectral filter along line of sight direction, and then the spatial filter along the K perpendicular. And you can see that, so these are the first three wiggles or peaks in the BAO. You can see that the spectral filter is currently just removing those entirely. And we're mainly probing nonlinear scales, so k greater than 0.1 in the angular direction and 0.25 in the line of sight direction. So this has to be taken into account in the modeling. So we assume the following model for the H1 galaxy cross power spectrum. So we assume both the galaxies and the hydrogen are linearly biased tracers of the total matter density. And then we include the effect of redshift space distortions at linear order, do the Kaiser effects here. We include a factor to account for fingers of God damping of both hydrogen and galaxies. We introduce this parameter alpha NL, which basically smoothly interpolates from a linear matter power spectrum to a nonlinear matter power spectrum based on a halo model. Then we have a shot noise term, which is basically sensitive to the average H1 mass within these galaxies.
The previous slide, just to see the ranges of K. Are you going to say more if you can retain more linear scales? Because as I understand, this is your special, or like the first step,
yeah,
which remove them. So can you kind of relax that principle?
That's what we're working on, yeah. Yeah, and it's unclear if we'll be successful. We're approaching it. We're developing new techniques in software to try to access the linear scales. But then we're also building the next generation telescope cord, and we've made specific design choices in hardware, if you will, to try to mitigate the errors that are corrupting the low K.
So these are instrumental errors or foreground?
Yeah, so it's the foreground power, and then the spectral response of the instrument is imprinted on the foregrounds and basically mixes that foreground power from smooth spectral scales to small spectral scales. And it's mainly the primary beam that's doing this. And I have a slide that I can show towards the end that sort of explains what's happening. So we're using a simulation pipeline to predict what signal we should see for a given set of model parameters. We generate a realization of large-scale structure for a given set of model parameters and create correlated fields for both the hydrogen and the tracers. For the hydrogen, we propagate the resulting 21-centimeter emission through an instrument model all the way to the raw time streams, and then we reapply the same processing that we applied to our actual data. So we're forward modeling everything here. We take the correlated galaxy density field and draw mock catalogs and then stack the simulated 21 centimeter on the simulated catalogs to get a template for this particular set of model parameters. That's a computationally intensive process. It takes about 1,000 core hours. So you can't put this in an MCMC to constrain the model parameters. But our signal, our stack signal, is linearly related to most of the model parameters. So by choosing different sets of parameters and running a simulation, so in total we need to do 17 different sets, we can generate 17 templates, which can be used to isolate how a given parameter affects the stack signal. And that can be put into an MCMC and used to constrain the parameters.
Linearly within the ranges that you're interested in, or stack linear dependence, or it's just expansion in small variations?
Yeah, so we're fundamentally sensitive to the cross power spectrum, and you can expand this out, and it's linear in most of the parameters, the exception being the fingers of God. And we have a special treatment of that.
I'm still kind of understand. So in the transfer function, this omega hi, for example, it doesn't enter linearly, I would say. Does it enter linearly? Or is it a kind of exact statement or a statement about the, kind of, in some small ranges, you can expand, Taylor expand linearly?
It doesn't require a Taylor expansion. So with omega H1, if you fix the other parameters and vary omega H1, the resulting cross power spectrum will just scale linearly with omega H1. And it's similar for most of these other parameters. So yeah, you have to judiciously choose sets of parameters that isolate a particular parameter and then construct a template for that. And that's kind of shown here. So our parameters of interest are the cosmic H1 density and the linear bias of H1. Those both affect the amplitude of the cross power spectrum. But we have these nuisance parameters, so the shot noise, the fingers of God damping, and then the nonlinear power spectrum. And if we were able to measure the cross power spectrum at all scales, so this is showing cross power spectrum and then the stacking signal after going through our pipeline. if we were able to measure this at all scales, we would easily distinguish, easily be able to constrain these parameters based on how they change the shape of the power spectrum. But our foreground filter removes everything less than 0.25 H inverse megaparsec. And in this space, the parameters are all highly degenerate. So we're not trying to constrain all eight parameters. We just want to include everything that we're aware of and then marginalize over the nuisance parameters to propagate the uncertainty on them into the parameters of interest, which are H1 density and linear bias. Here are the resulting parameter constraints. So I'm not showing all of the parameters. I'm showing the combinations that remove the strong degeneracies that are present. So we're primarily sensitive to this AH1 parameter, which is the product of the density and the linear bias plus the average Kaiser term. And that's, the constraints are shown here. If you fix the nuisance parameters at their fiducial values in blue, or if you allow them to float. You can see that the uncertainty dramatically increases when you allow this nonlinear modeling to float. But we're still, even still, we're ruling out zero at high significance. We very clearly have a detection of the signal. It's just inferring the H1 density is limited by the nonlinear modeling. We're starting to place interesting constraints on the shot noise, and we anticipate being able to do so once we include more data and improve the signal to noise. And that's interesting for studying galaxy formation, since it gives you the average mass in whatever sample of galaxies, average H1 mass in whatever sample of galaxies you're stacking on.
Can you mean with bias or bias galaxies?
Sorry?
Can you measure the bias? The galaxy or...
So we can't really measure the bias. We can measure like this combination of, yeah.
Just look at the constraint of the bias. That's consistent. Because you cross-correlate actually with the solid, I mean, it's a certain.
Yeah, so we do use the bias measurements from the spectroscopic surveys. Those are measured quite well, the bias of the actual galaxies. But the bias of the H1 is highly degenerate with the density. And I'm not sure, I don't think we can constrain, we can't constrain either one individually, yeah.
Was the hydrogen galaxies okay, but what about the bias for the galaxy bias?
Yeah.
You also have your parameter in, you also have this parameter in your bias.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, but there we're actually using the prior from, that's provided by EBOS, and they measure it much better than we could. We would have these, it would also suffer from the same general degeneracy.
Do your measurements span a wide enough range of mu that you could maybe do this like f over v ratio?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think they do span a wider range of mu, and you could try perhaps, isolating. We have large signal to noise. You could have perhaps apply different filters to isolate specific contributions. Yeah. But that's not something we've tried.
So for now, you're just focusing on like a model.
So these are the if we do place a prior on the bias of hydrogen based on the differences observed in simulations, you can then place a constraint on the density, and that's what's shown here. And we've compared to other measurements from other telescopes using a variety of different techniques for measuring this. The error bars are quite large. We're consistent with the other measurements, but the error bars are very large. And that's mainly due, again, to the nonlinear modeling. We have done a fairly thorough job of incorporating the nonlinear modeling, and that's not the case for all of these other measurements. If we fix the nonlinear parameters at their fiducial values, you get something that looks like this. So each colored point here is a different tracer as measured by Chime. And this is just demonstrating the internal consistency of our measurement and the significance of the detection, but it doesn't represent the plausible range of H1 values we expect because of this uncertainty in the nonlinear modeling. And then I'm a bit short on time, so I'll just quickly move through the next few slides. So we also measure a significant shift in the peak location or the centroid location of the quasar stack, which we think is due to a systematic bias in the quasar redshifts. So if you convert that to a systematic velocity error, you get something like 66 kilometers per second at 3 sigma for the quasars, whereas the LRGs and ELGs are consistent with zero. So we think this is real, and EBOS also sees evidence of this and some of the tests that they've run. And this is an example of using cross-correlation to calibrate systematic errors in the individual surveys.
Are you saying that there's an error in QSO, in EBOS QSO redshifts? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what it looks like from this measurement. So we see a bias in the systematic bias in the quasar redshifts of 66 kilometers per second.
There'd be some sort of systematic offset between the neutral hydrogen and stars. Maxi, or I guess for QSO, I'm not sure about lines dominated, but I mean, there are velocities, things are moving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a very big velocity, right?
Yeah. So I think so. EBOS compares their redshifts to measurements or a subset of quasars, measurements of the redshift from emission lines in the host galaxy. And they see sort of similar offsets for this redshift range.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, like, could this be something like inflow or outflow? Probably neutral hydrogen wouldn't be the same place.
Right.
Optical lines are.
Yeah, but the host galaxies, I think you were saying, show similar.
Yeah.
The question is, it a systematic effect or is it an astrophysical effect?
So there are additional cross correlation studies we're working on. We want to extend to higher redshifts with the quasars. Cross-correlating against the Lyman Alpha Forest from EBOS, and then DESI will just increase the number of all of these objects by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude and has excellent overlap with CHIME. So that will enable some really spectacular science in general, but also cross-correlation with CHIME. But you know, long-term, we want to measure the 21 power spectrum using CHIME beta only. And that's straightforward at these small spectral scales where we're getting down to close to thermal noise. And a detection there would be a first of its kind. But eventually, we need to go to larger spectral scales where the BAO lives, shown here. And to do that, we need some combination of better calibration of our primary beam and better techniques for foreground removal. So what, you know, measuring this cross-correlation, having this cross-correlation detection is a useful metric that we can judge different techniques against. And if we're able to identify the BAO, you would then use that to constrain dark energy. These are predictions, like what you could do assuming only thermal noise with CHIME for 1 year of data, which we have in hand right now. And so CHIME is shown in orange. This is the volume distance inferred from both the line of sight and spatial extent of the BAO relative to the fiducial value, and comparing it to DESI in blue and gray, and then the previous EBOS measurements over here. And our forecasts are excellent. So, you know, 1 year of data, you would get sub-percent measurements of this quantity across our redshift range, which are comparable to DESI, but they're not realistic in the sense that right now we're entirely dominated by foregrounds on the relevant scales. So for CHIME and I think 21 centimeter intensity mapping in general, at least at late times, the key is developing the telescope characterization techniques and foreground removal techniques to access these large scale linear modes. CORD is fully funded. It's a next generation radio interferometer that will be built over the next 3 years and consist of 512 6-meter dishes. It will also have three outrigger stations to enable millisecond localization of FRBs. So it will have a lower system temperature and larger collecting area, which will reduce the noise by a factor of 4 relative to CHIME. And in terms of mapping speed, which is given by sort of the redshift coverage, so it also significantly increases the redshift coverage. So we're going from 0 to 3.7 compared to CHIME 0.8 to 2.5. It's an order of magnitude more powerful in this metric, delta Z number of beams divided by the variance of the noise, which is basically giving you some kind of survey volume per time. And we've designed CORD to mitigate some of the problems that have been found in CHIME that currently prevent us from accessing the large-scale linear modes. So we're moving away from cylinders to parabolic dishes. We're using a very low F number to reduce ground spill and crosstalk. The dishes, the manufacturing process has sub-millimeter precision. This is a measurement of two prototype dishes. This is the deviation from a ideal parabola. This is a measurement, and the precision is sub-millimeter. You can see that the two dishes deviate in very similar ways. So even if we have deviations from a perfect beam, they will be the same for all cylinders, or same for the dishes, and we'll have to characterize a single beam.
We'll have to make sure to align them the same direction on the mounts.
Yeah, so yeah, they're also like millimeter tolerances in terms of alignment.
Better be the same orientation.
So this is the summary. We have a decisive detection, but currently we're limited by modeling nonlinear scales, and we need to either improve that modeling or mitigate these systematic errors at linear scales. And we're doing that, we're pursuing that in software with CHIME and also in hardware with CORD. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
2 minutes for questions for a second. So basic question. So on your previous slide, you talked about better beam modeling. Mm-hmm. Is it possible just to like directly measure?
Yeah, so, right, so what I've sort of been working on is using what we know about the radio sky, about these extragalactic point sources, to try to solve for the beam. So there are many high-resolution sky surveys that catalog the point source sky on either side of the beam and or on either side of the chime band. And we can use that to try to develop a model for our beam. We've had a lot of success using the sun to map out the beam. There's also talk of using drones. So broadcasting a signal from a drone. One issue is that the far field of the Chime telescope is like kilometers. So if you wanted to measure the beam in the far field, you'd have to, it's sort of at the limit of what you can do with the drone. You would probably have to make a measurement in the near field and then propagate that to the far field, or model how that evolves, at least for Chime. With Chord, with the 6-meter dish, the far field is much closer, so drones are an easier method, yeah. But, I mean, you also have issues with, ensuring that your drone is broadcasting a stable signal, at least for measuring the sort of absolute beam response. So there are a lot of challenges with that as well.
We use satellites for that. Everyone is complaining that there are too many satellites.
Yeah.
And you should know their frequency and the
yeah.
Really.
Yes. Yep. John Sievers at McGill recently showed some interesting results using a satellite. Seemed to get very good measurements of the beam, that's still being evaluated. One issue with satellites is that they only broadcast at specific frequencies. So this is not going to give you the beam over your full band, but it could give you very high precision measurements at a single frequency, which would be definitely useful in the beam modeling effort. But yeah, the whole idea here is characterizing the beam and then deconvolving that from the data to move the power, the foreground power from the large spectral scales, from the BAO scales to the large spectral scales.
Small scale is actually easy to measure.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we're showing here. We're able to measure the 21 centimeter signal at small scales.
I mean, the signal is expected to be more robust.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.